Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I am Gordy Jones, and joining me as always from a socially distant remove is that Mike Gross. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Gordy. This might be our last time.
That's true. Now that the vaccines have been administered, we can hopefully look forward to the day when we'll be in the same room. And joining us on the phone line is Ray Didinger. You would know him most recently as a pro football commentator for NBC Sports Philadelphia and also for his weekend show with Glenn Macnow on WIP AM radio. Others will remember him as a writer for the Daily News, the Philadelphia Daily News, and before that, the Philadelphia Bulletin. He is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He's also the author of 12 books, the most recent of which is coming out on May 26th. It is called Finished Business. So welcome to you, Ray.
Thanks, Gordy. Good to be with you.
And Ray, we want to talk obviously about the just completed NFL draft, in which the Eagles drafted Alabama wide receiver Devontae Smith in the first round and Alabama offensive lineman Landon Dickerson in the second. Of course, the questions about Devontae are about his frame. The questions about Landon are about his injury history. Despite that, the Eagles have been graded very highly for their draft. I wonder what you think of how they did and what you think about those two guys in particular.
I thought overall it was good. I think they hit a 500-foot home run on Thursday night, with the Devontae Smith. Getting Devontae Smith, I think that was a great get. And they had to do a little fancy footwork to do it. They came very, very close to being sort of shut out there. I mean, they really should send a fruit basket out to the Denver Broncos, because that they kind of really made the whole thing possible. If the Denver Broncos hadn't made the trade for Teddy Bridgewater, I think the Denver Broncos take Justin Fields at nine, and then the Cowboys take Patrick Surtain. And then the Giants take Devontae Smith, and then the Eagles are sitting there at 12, sort of looking around and saying, "Okay, now what do we do?" but the fact that Denver had already gotten their quarterback, now Denver was free to take Surtain, and then all of a sudden, the ball started rolling in the Eagles' direction. And they knew, and everybody pretty much knew for a couple of weeks, the Giants were definitely locked in on Smith. So for the Eagles to get him, they had to get ahead of the Giants, and they swung the deal, and they got him. So that was, that's got things off on a great start. It really was. I mean, that was exciting for the team. It was exciting for the fans. And I think he's really good. I know there are concerns about his size. I know there's concerns about 165-pound guys surviving in the NFL. I just think this guy's special. I think he's that rare player who's going to be able to do things that other guys couldn't do. So that was great. And then after that, I think things got a little sketchy. The thing that, when I look at the draft, I look at it kind of two ways. I look at what they did, and then there's the other part of me that I say, I look at what they could have done.
Right.
And I look at when they came up in the when they came up at number 37 in the second round. When you're drafting, sometimes there are things that happen that you can't foresee. There are opportunities that present themselves that you couldn't have foreseen, but there they are. And then all of a sudden, you kind of have to change direction and say, well, what do we do now? And I kind of thought that's what happened at 37. I mean, in fact, I never thought that Christian Barmore was going to be available. I mean, I thought he was going to be certainly a first-round pick. And he, all of a sudden, he falls into 37, and now he's on the board. And if I had been the Eagles, I would have taken Barmore there. I would have, Dickerson's a fine player, really good. And if you just look at his tape, I mean, he's a very worthy pick at that point. But I wouldn't have thought he would have had an opportunity to get a guy like Barmore, who I really think is first round value at 37. And if I had been in the Eagles' shoes there and I had that choice, I would have taken Barmore.
Ray, what do you make of, if anything, do you make of the little moment that Howie Roseman and Tom Donahoe had, or that we all saw on video? I've never seen anything quite like that before, because obviously in these situation rooms, they're all trying to everybody's happy and everybody's thrilled and everybody's delighted. Does that say anything about Howie Roseman? Does it say anything about anything? What did you think of that?
Well, it obviously says that, that Tom was unhappy with what went down there. And he made no real attempt. I'm sure Tom wasn't thinking this is on television. You know, I'm sure Tom, I mean, he knows there's a camera in the room, but at that moment, he's not thinking about that. He's not worrying about that. He's just reacting to what had happened. And I mean, I don't know for a fact, but I'm guessing that he was, you know, he was probably a guy in the room that was saying, at 70, let's go get Aaron Robinson, who's a cornerback, who's a good player, a really good player, really good slot defender from Central Florida. Another guy who started at Alabama and then transferred to Central Florida. There's a real strong Alabama theme here, but it's a little bit like the Barrymore situation. And all of a sudden, here's a guy sitting there that you didn't think was going to be there, but he is. And from the Eagles' standpoint, it's at a position where you really need players. And I thought, again, I'm watching the draft go down, and I'm seeing the pick coming up, and the Eagles are coming up at 70, and I see Aaron Robinson still there, and I thought, man, they have really lucked out here. I thought this guy was going to be a high two. He's available to them in three. They need a corner. This guy can really play. He was my number six cornerback overall in the whole draft. And I'm sure Tom Donahoe in the room was saying exactly that. And then Howie, it comes up to it, and then if the phone rings and Howie has a chance to trade down three spots and pick up an extra sixth round pick. And, you know, Howie just can't resist that kind of stuff. So he makes the deal with the thought that, well, we're only moving down three spots. We can probably still get Aaron Robinson. I've been around this game long enough to know that whenever you make that decision, it almost never works. The guy that you think is going to be there is never there, and that's what happened. The Eagles passed on him. The Giants trade up to take him, and Tom was very upset. You know, I don't know. It was a matter that he didn't like Milton Williams, the kid that they did wind up with. But what I really think happened was that Tom was, and I think quite justifiably, was saying, hey, you know, we got Aaron Robinson right here. We need a cornerback. This kid's a good player. Let's take him. And Howie decided to roll the dice and try and get one more sixth round pick. And Tom, being the old school kind of just play the board kind of guy, he wasn't on board with that even a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in round four, they do get a corner. I'd be interested to know what you think of Zach McPherson, because I cover Penn State, and he was at Penn State, as you know, he was there, didn't get a lot of traction there, and then ended up being a pretty good corner in the Big 12, which I'm not sure that isn't a contradiction in terms, a good corner in the Big 12, I don't know, maybe that's being a little harsh. What do you think of McPherson?
I liked him. I thought that, that's right about where I thought he would go. I wouldn't say that he was a steal. He was a guy that there are certain aspects of his game that you like. There are other things that you said he needs to work on. But right at that point where, I know everybody's saying they're following the board. But at that point, I mean, I think everybody's thinking, will you please go get a defensive back? I mean, you know, please? Yeah. I mean, really? And so I don't know if they insist that he had the highest grade of anybody on their board. I think they might be fudging that a little bit. But I think at that point, somebody in the room said, hey, let's go get a corner, okay? And if McPherson was their highest rated corner, then I think that makes some sense. He's, I know he started at Penn State and then transferred to Texas Tech, and they don't play a whole heck of a lot of defense in that conference. Anybody who watches the Big 12, you know that. But the one thing it does do is it tells you whether the cornerbacks can play or not, because the ball's in the air all the time. And, you know, this kid's got good size. I mean, he's just a shade under 6 feet tall. He's got a good, solid frame. Not afraid to tackle. And he can run. I mean, he was a 4.39 40 guy, which is pretty fast. To me, I'm not sure if he's a border corner, the guy that plays outside the hashes, or if he's more of a slot defender. I kind of see him more as a slot guy. But I think he can play. For a team that, you know, right now you look at their defensive backfield, I mean, they got Darius Slay and and nobody. So they needed to start bringing some guys in there, and I kind of agree with them. At that point, if they were going defensive back, I thought that McPherson was the best available.
Okay. Now, regarding Devontae, one of the dynamics of this is he's reunited with Jalen Hurts, with whom he played at Alabama years ago. I mean, how much does that mean, if anything, at a whole new level?
Oh, it can only help. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can only help. The time that they've spent together, the familiarity they have, I mean, that can only help. Mm-hmm. I mean, you saw last year, over an entire season, the quarterbacks and these young receivers never got on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Wentz never got on the same page with Rager or Hightower while Watkins didn't play.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hurts got in there and a little bit, but then, you know, Fulgham was hot, then Fulgham was out. And, I mean, the whole thing just never worked. And mm-hmm. and part of it was just at the beginning of the year that, you know, they had so many new parts in the passing game. I mean, right. you had Rager was a rookie, Hightower was a rookie. Fulgham had been around but hadn't hardly played. And the quarterbacks, Wentz initially, just, you could tell he just didn't trust any of them. I mean, mm-hmm. he didn't, you know, I know everybody, it's so easy to say, oh, he holds the ball too long. What are you holding the ball? Well, you know, if you looked at the overview of the field, you saw the whole field, you kind of understood why he was holding the ball. I mean, nobody was open, and the receivers were running terrible routes, and he couldn't trust where they were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if these guys were disciplined route runners, you know, you can do what they call throw in anticipation. If I know where this guy's going to make his break, I know where he's going to be. Yeah, I can let the ball go before he turns around. And that's the way it's supposed to work in the NFL. But none of these guys had any of that. You never knew where they were going to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were never where they were supposed to be. So Wentz would have to hold the ball, wait for them to turn and to find out where they are, and now he's going to throw it. That's when he got in trouble. So you're starting off now with, and there's no question that Smith will be a starter. I mean, he's going to start right from day one, and he should.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got, he and Hurts can start right out with, they already kind of know how it works. I mean, Hurts knows exactly the kind of routes that Smith likes to run. Smith knows exactly when the ball's going to be coming.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they'll, first day of practice, I mean, they'll, in terms of timing, they'll be back at Tuscaloosa. You know, it's going to feel like, oh yeah, we've done this before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's a good place to start. I mean, there's no question that Smith's going to be the frontline guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any question that Hurts is going to be the starting quarterback. And, you know, they start off with a nice little foundation of understanding and knowing their moves, and most of all the trust. I mean, they'll start off with a level of trust that I don't think Wentz had with any of his receivers last year.
Mm-hmm. Now, frame-wise, one of the comparisons that people have made with Devontae is with Marvin Harrison. I mean, do you see that just simply from a body type-wise? Is that an accurate assessment in your mind?
Yeah, I think it's pretty apt. Mm-hmm. I do. You know, I don't normally like to make that kind of comparison. I don't normally like to compare player to player.
Right.
I never think that's quite fair for either guy. And I'm particularly reluctant to do it when you're talking about a Hall of Famer.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
When you're talking about a rookie to a Hall of guys in the Hall of Fame, I always think that's really a stretch. But I do think this is a case where there is some validity to it. It goes beyond the fact that they're about the same size.
Mm-hmm.
The way they run,
mm-hmm.
The way they create space in their routes, their acceleration, their ability to get that kind of 0 to 60 thing,
mm-hmm.
And they make it look, the thing with Harrison, and you see it with Smith, is they make it look really effortless.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're so smooth in their movements. It looks like they're on rollerblades. You know, I mean, there's some guys that are really super fast, but you see them chugging, and you see their arms pumping, and you see their, you know, the turf flying out behind them, and they, you know, they're moving fast, and it looks like they're moving fast. And then there are other guys that are so smooth, you almost don't realize how fast they're going.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way Harrison was, and that's the way Smith is. You know, Waddle probably, in terms of the 40-yard dash, times faster
mm-hmm.
than Smith, and it's been demonstrated he does. But in terms of how fast they play, running their routes and their ability to separate,
mm-hmm.
And their ability to maintain speed in and out of their cuts, I would contend that Smith actually is the faster of the two players in terms of how it translates into actually making plays on the field. And Marvin Harrison had the same thing. And, you know, Marvin was almost the same size, a little bit bigger, but not much. And, you know, Marvin caught over 1,000 passes in the NFL and was hardly ever hurt. I mean, the only time he really missed any time was he got hurt making a block. But he never got hurt catching the ball. And a lot of it was because a lot of his routes were sideline routes. They were sort of deep outs, shortcuts. And he had a quarterback. He was really good at running those outside routes. And he had a quarterback in Peyton Manning that was really good at throwing that ball. And they had you talk about chemistry between a quarterback and a receiver. They really had it. Mm-hmm. To the point where, I mean, Manning used to joke that he could close his eyes and throw the ball. And he knew exactly where Harrison was going to be. And that's not much of an exaggeration. That was kind of how it looked, and that was how it played. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the kind of receiver that Smith is going to be. I mean, he's going to be able to run those same kinds of patterns, catch a lot of passes, and get out of bounds before the defense can lay a big lick on him.
Hmm.
Ray, what you were saying about Brent, about Wentz not being able to trust his receivers, that was really interesting to me. Will coaching help a little bit with the new people that they brought in? Because I don't think a lot of people have a sense of what kind of coaches these guys are, but there is some wide receiver coach background in their staff now. Will that help? I just am intrigued by what you said about that.
Well, I hope so. One of the things that surprises me, I mean, there's been, as there very often is whenever there's a head coaching change, there's really a wholesale turnover in the entire coaching staff, pretty much. And that's been true with the Eagles, too. But one of the few coaches that bring it back is the wide receiver coach, which I can't begin to explain how that happened. I mean, the Eagles every year have been changing wide receiver coaches, it seems like, for a decade. And then this year, when you absolutely had every reason to get a new receiver coach, they kept this guy. Aaron Morehead, I have no idea. I mean, to me, you know, you look at this Eagles team last year, I mean, a team that, on the whole, underachieved horribly. But if you ask me what position underachieved the most of the team, I would tell you, I think it was the receivers. And, you know, how you retain that position coach, I have no idea. I don't think Devontae Smith needs a whole lot of coaching. I mean, to me, he looks like he looks like a guy that knows how to play the position, and I think he's going to come right in and he'll hit the ground running. The other guys need a lot of work. I mean, frankly, the route running by Rager, especially, to me, was just it was awful. I didn't think he was a first round. I didn't think he should have been a first round draft pick anyway. I mean, I think the Eagles really blew that one. Everybody, we've all talked endlessly about, you know, Rager and Jefferson, Rager versus Jefferson. Well, there's no versus to it. I mean, there's no comparison between the two of them. But now you got Rager, and you've got the investment of a first round player there, and you're going to have to try and make him into something. And, you know, they drafted him because they thought that he was, they referred to him as a kind of a gadget player, which is really what he was. He's a guy that they move around the formation. He's a guy that can play in the slot. He's a guy that they can throw a lot of those quick screens to. They can jet sweep him. They can get him the ball. You know, those little quick screen passes and let him run with it, use his speed. That's really what they're kind of going to. But that's he was never really, if you saw him play in college, he was never a guy that ran particularly good routes in college, or he was never a guy that made a ton of big plays down the field. He's elusive once he's got the ball in his hands. And they kind of wanted to build that kind of offense. They kind of were hoping he would do the same kinds of things that Tariq Hill can do. But, I mean, he's nowhere near as creative and nowhere near as fast. So I really felt that that was one of the big problems in the offense. And, you know, you go back to just for a case in point, week one of the season. You know, the Eagles go to Washington, and they're playing Washington week one, and they're up 17-0. It looks like they're gonna blow Washington out. I mean, it looks like a typical Eagles Washington game. It's actually boring at 17-0, and you're looking at it and saying, "Well, we've seen this before." You know, the Eagles are gonna win this game, you know, 31-7, and we'll just move on to week two. And all of a sudden, you know, they call an out route to Rager. And he runs this lazy, you know, sort of banana kind of thing where he rounds it off and he's late coming out of the break and he's late looking for the ball. And he's way out of position, and Wentz tries, he's trying to force the ball in there. It gets picked off. Guy picks it off and takes it back, and now all of a sudden, it's not 17-0 anymore. It's 17-7. And that changed the whole game.
I really did. I remember that exact play, and that changed everything. You are exactly right about that. I didn't really notice the route like you did, but yeah, no question. That changed everything.
Yeah, go back and look at that. I mean, that play, I've never seen a game. I can't remember seeing a game flip on one play quite like that one. I mean, Eagles are in complete control of that game, and that play breaks down, and everybody blames Wentz. Everybody blames the quarterback.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm looking at it, and I'm saying that's a terrible route. And with the way Rager ran the route, I mean, Wentz was probably wrong for trying to throw the ball. But the real problem is created by Rager not cutting the route exactly where he was supposed to. And then the next possession or two possessions later, they try to run it in. They try to run a dig with Hightower. And he gets into the traffic and all of a sudden sort of pulls up. And that's your next interception.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden 17-14 and you're on your way to losing a game that you should have won. Mm. And I honestly think they never recovered from that. And I'm not sure Wentz ever recovered from that. I mean, there was a game that they had in hand, and it totally turned on two plays that were interceptions. And while everybody will say the interceptions were the quarterback's fault, I will tell you that I felt both of those interceptions were the fault of the rookie receivers not running the routes properly.
That's crazy.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Just to tie up a loose end for our listeners, Aaron Moorhead is the wide receiver coach who the Eagles have retained, so that as Ray mentioned, that will bear watching given what a disaster that whole positional group was last year.
But one of the points I probably should make following up is the fact that Nick Sirianni, the new head coach, really he's a receivers coach. I mean, he was a receiver in college. He came to the NFL as a receiver coach, graduated to offensive coordinator, and now head coach. But he is by experience, and he is by definition a receiver coach. So I have a feeling that if you're watching practice this year, that Nick Sirianni is going to be very hands-on in terms of coaching the receivers. Because everything I heard from the people in Indianapolis was he's really good at it. He's a really good technician. He's a really good teacher. He really has really good ideas about drills for the receivers, how to improve them. And that's a great thing. Because you have some guys here that have some talent. I mean, Rager has some talent, but he really needs a ton of work to get up to speed. And I like Hightower. I think Hightower has the kind of long rangey speed that a little bit Todd Pinkston like in his ability to really stretch the field and make big plays down the field. But he's very raw, and he needs some good teaching. So you've got some talent there, but it just really needs to be developed. And you know, last year Aaron Moorhead didn't show me the ability to kind of do that, but I'm hoping that Nick Sirianni, even though he's the head coach, is probably going to function a lot as a receivers coach and try and get more out of this group.
Yeah, makes sense. That makes sense. Dickerson, will Dickerson be able to step in at guard, do you think, Ray?
If he's healthy, he can. Yeah, if he's healthy, he can. He's played every position on the line. He played when he was at Florida State. He played some tackle even. Now I don't think that's really his position, but he can play out there. He can definitely play the three inside positions. He can definitely play both guards and center. And this year, I mean, you got probably one more year of Jason Kelce. So he'll play that out. And Kelce can play through almost anything. I mean, he gets so banged up, but he keeps playing. So I would expect that he's going to play the whole year because that's just the way Jason Kelce rolls. But Dickerson, if he doesn't get injured and he comes in healthy and he stays healthy, he's too good a player to be on the bench. He's really too good a player to be on the bench. I'm sure he'll get some snaps at center in practice and in the preseason, but I think what they're really going to try and do with him is if Kelce is well and he's playing like we've seen Jason Kelce play, that they're going to give Dickerson a chance to compete at the guard position. And, you know, we've seen Brandon Brooks is really a good player, but he's had trouble making it through the year. And Sayamalu to me is okay. I don't know that he's a whole lot better than okay. And I think that straight up, if you give Dickerson a chance to compete there, he would win that job. He's a very good player. He's a very good player. And the only problem with him is he gets hurt all the time. And, you know, I mean, he's had four college seasons now that he couldn't complete. I mean, four college seasons, he's finished the year on crutches. And that's scary to me. It really is. But, I mean, but if you take that out of it, it's hard to do, but you take that out of it and you just look at what you see on the tape, he's very good. I mean, he's got tremendous size, real power. He can move. He's a really good technician. You can see he's been really well coached. His footwork is really good. His hands are really good. For a big man, for a 320-pound man, he can move pretty well. He can make some blocks on the second level, which you wouldn't expect. And he just buries people. I mean, he just puts people in the ground. And he's got that kind of John Runyon meanness about him that I know the coaches like. So there's a lot to like in Landon Dickerson. I just wish he were a little healthier.
Yeah, there you go.
Heading into the draft, Ray, there was some speculation that Zach Ertz might be packaged in a trade. Do you expect that he'll be on the week one roster next year? Or is that, are they ready to move on from him?
No, I think they're moving on. I would be very surprised if Zach is here in week one. You know, I think that he was out there to be had during draft weekend. I think most people kind of thought that he would be dealt then. But, you know, Howie has a price in mind. And he's not going to give him away. And so I'm sure people were calling and asking. And, you know, Howie said, no, not for that. No, I don't know if he's asking for a four or whatever, but it didn't happen. But I think that what's going to happen, I would guess, is that now that we're past the draft and we've been past the first big wave of free agency, teams now they've got their board up and they see what they've got. You know, up until then, you're talking about speculatively, well, we'll try and add here, and we'll try and add here, and, you know, maybe we'll bring in a guy here. All the things that you think you might do. Well, now you're kind of through that. And now you look at your board, now you know, okay, now this is what we got. And, you know, there's probably going to be a couple teams that will look at their board and say, oh, you know what, we really could use another tight end. We could really use a veteran tight end. You know, we didn't get that in the draft. You know, let's call the Eagles and see what the price is for Ertz. That's what's going to happen. I mean, some of the people now that they have a chance to sort of sift through what they've got after free agency, what they've got after the draft, you know, they're going to look at their board and say, hey, you know, we're thin at that position. Let's call Philadelphia and see what the situation is with Ertz. So you'll get that, and you'll see, you know, Howie was very clear in his final press conference when the question of Zach Ertz came up. You know, he said, hey, listen, you know, he's still a good player. No, this is not a guy in the twilight of his career. You know, great guy. We love him here. Career Eagle, blah, blah, blah. So the message Howie's sending out is I ain't giving him away. You know, he's trying to tell you that, you know, listen, we're not definitely giving him away. If we can't, if you want to make a trade, we'll make a trade. But, you know, if we don't get the right price, he'll just stay with us. I kind of think that was Howie posturing, you know, Howie trying to keep the price up or maybe even drive the price up a little bit. But I don't think, to me, it just doesn't seem like it's headed in that direction in a real world kind of way. You know, I think that somewhere between now, you know, there's going to be a couple injuries in training camp, a couple injuries in the preseason. Somebody's going to really need a wide tight end. And, you know, Zach will be appealing. And I don't know what price Howie's going to get for it, but I think he'll move him one. And other teams are kind of sitting back out there, and they don't want to give anything up. They're still figuring, well, if it really comes to it, Howie will just cut him, and I'll get him for nothing. One way or the other, be it as a release and a signing or a trade for like a fifth-round pick or a sixth-round pick, I kind of see that happening. It looks to me like – and anybody that saw Zach after the final game last year, I mean, you kind of saw – where this thing was headed. I mean, he sat on the bench for like 15 minutes after the game, just looking around and taking it all in. And then he had the press conference the next day where he broke down in tears and talked about what Philly meant to him and all. So, I mean, he's a little unhappy with the way things went down at the end. I mean, he felt like he and Howie kind of had it out in a kind of public setting. And it's hard to kind of move past that kind of thing. Yeah. So I think at this point, And, you know, Zach only has a couple years left, and I don't think the Eagles are going to be are in a position to contend for anything of meaning. So if Zach's only got a couple years left, I think it'll be nice, and I think he would welcome the opportunity to play those years with a team that actually has a chance to win.
Wow.
On another tack, Ray, I just wonder what your assessment of Jalen Hurts might be. I know it was a really limited sample size this past year, 4 starts, but what did you think of how he did?
You know, some good, some bad. I mean, kind of the profile of the typical rookie quarterback. That's kind of what you get most of the time. Mm-hmm. I kind of, the best way of putting it is I saw enough that I want to see more. Okay. You know, I think that you saw, certainly in the New Orleans game, and even in the Arizona game, that he had some really good moments. I mean, the New Orleans game, he played really well. Mm-hmm. Arizona game, even though they lost, he threw the ball well. Mm-hmm. Then the Dallas game, he was sort of up and down. And then the Washington game, he was pretty ineffective. Mm-hmm. I think what happened is, and this is, you know, to me, it wasn't an accident. With each week, he got less effective. The more teams got film on him, the more teams were able to study him, they were able to hone in on him, take away some of the things he did well, and kind of contain him, make him play in the pocket, and make him make tougher throws. The New Orleans game, I mean, the New Orleans team was a good team, and they came in hot.
Yeah.
But if you looked at what the Saints had done previous to that week, they really hadn't faced a mobile quarterback. I mean, if you look at their schedule, all the quarterbacks they had played were generally pocket kinds of guys. They hadn't really faced a quarterback that had any real mobility, and they were playing a quarterback that they had never seen at all. I mean, Hurts was a complete mystery to them, and he was a mystery in a way that they had never really had to defend against, which is a guy that could really get out of the pocket and be a dual threat and run some real RPO things in a really threatening kind of way. And as a result, that New Orleans defense was off balance the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that really helped Hurts a lot. And he took advantage of it. He played really well. He looked very calm, never looked sort of overwhelmed by it, and was really in control. And the team certainly responded, and the crowd certainly responded. And he brought life to a season that was pretty much dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really good. I mean, that was a great first start against a good opponent, and he comes away with a win. That's impressive. But with each week, you could see teams were kind of had him figured out. Now he wasn't nearly as much of a mystery. They had an idea of what kind of plays that he liked to run, and they did a better job of preparing to take that away from him. And that's what he's going to face now, moving into year number two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now this is where, you know, this is the hard part when you come back that next year, and all of a sudden teams have kind of seen what you do, and they're going to try and stack their defense in ways that are going to give you a problem. And now it comes a matter of they've adjusted to you. Now you have to adjust to their adjustment. And some young quarterbacks are able to do it seamlessly, and other guys really struggle with it. And that's where we are with Jalen Hurts. But I know there's a lot of talk in this offseason about trading for this guy, trading for that guy, drafting another quarterback, which I think would have been ridiculous. I mean, you know, going to draft another quarterback, come on. I mean, you made this trade last year. I think this year is all about just finding out about Jalen Hurts, just giving this kid a full year behind a hopefully better and healthier offensive line, and just seeing at the end of the year, what do you got? You know, I don't think anybody thinks this team's going to a Super Bowl. But use this year to develop this quarterback and see if he's a guy that you can move forward with and hopefully build a team around, or not, or come to the end and say, you know what, no, he's not the answer. And next year, you got 3 first-round draft picks where maybe you can go get the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, makes sense. Ray, tell us about the book. We got to sell some books here, my man.
Yeah, well, the book is called Finish Business, and it's my 50 years of headlines, heroes, and heartaches. And it's basically a recounting of, you know, kind of my memoirs of 50 years of working in the sports media business here in Philadelphia. I honestly don't think I would have written it if the Eagles hadn't won a Super Bowl. I kind of think that the Eagles Super Bowl win and what that meant to the city and that whole celebration, it just was a lovely kind of moment that kind of put a nice little ribbon on my 50 years here. I'd seen the Flyers win 2 cups. I had covered 2 Phillies World Series. Right. I had seen the Sixers win a championship. And when the Eagles finally brought home that Lombardi Trophy, it kind of signified, okay, yeah, that was the finished business. You know, now we finally got that Lombardi Trophy, and everybody can sit back and enjoy. And so that's when I decided, let me just try this. I didn't even know it was going to work. I told the people at Temple Press, I said, let me just start it and see where it goes. I may decide after 20, 30 pages that this isn't working and we'll just forget about it. But yeah, I started writing it and everything just kind of fell into place. So that's it. It's a sort of a 50-year walk through Philadelphia sports history, the good, the bad, and everything in between.
That's a great idea. Yeah, I mean, that'll be fun. I think I'm looking forward to reading that. Tell us a little bit about the three of us have all been doing this for a long, long time. The changes in the business, and do you regard them as positive changes or negative changes? I realize that's a really big open-ended one, but just take it wherever you're sort of think of first.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's totally changed from what it was when I got into it. I mean, I got out of college in 68, got hired by the Bulletin to cover high schools in 69. I got promoted to went from the high school beat to the Eagles beat in 1970. I was just 23 years old.
Wow.
So I've been covering the team in one way or another for, you know, 52 years. So I've seen a lot of change in that period of time, a lot of change. I mean, when I first started in 1970, you know, I'd go on the road. I remember my first road trip was Eagles Lions preseason game in Detroit. Back then they played 6 preseason games. Remember? Oof, can you believe that?
Remember that? Yeah.
And played an exhibition game out in Old Tiger Stadium. Don't even think that's there anymore. We got in on a Friday and went to my hotel room, took out my portable typewriter, put the paper in the carriage, wrote my story, and then went downstairs, walked outside, and hailed a cab and said, "Take me to the Western Union office." And we had to drive all over Detroit to find a Western Union office that was open at 1 o'clock in the morning. And then walked in, and, you know, the guy in there he's used to sending out telegrams that say, "Hi, Mom, send money," 4 words at that. And here I hand him 5 pages of double-spaced copy, and he looked at me like I had 5 heads. And that's how copy was transmitted in those days. I mean, you went and you found a Western Union office, and the guy in there, hopefully he was sober, would retype your story and send it to the office, and then there'd be a typesetter there that he would retype it, and you hoped he was sober, and then we'd get the paper. Sometimes it looked like what you wrote, and sometimes it didn't. So we went from that to the land of computers and the immediate technology of today, and it's a whole different world. It really is. And, you know, to me, the saddest part is the fact that at 1970, when I first got into it, newspapers were the king. I mean, newspapers ruled everything. There was no ESPN. There was no sports talk radio. There was no cable TV. There was no Comcast Sportsnet. There was none of that. I mean, everybody got their news from the newspaper. And now that's not the case. I mean, now, you know, because of the deadlines and because of what newspapers are, and because they've been so overshadowed by the immediacy of everybody getting scores and highlights on their cell phone, now, you know, I get my morning Inquirer delivered here, and I pick it up, and, you know, the Phillies are playing a home game at 7 o'clock. I get my paper the next morning. They don't even have the score.
Yeah.
It says, "Oh, the game ended too late for this edition," you know, or if the Flyers game or the Sixers game, you know, the game is being played 5 blocks from where I'm living, and at 8 o'clock the next morning, I'm picking it up. "Now, game is too late for this edition." So it's wholly different. It's really different. And, you know, I'm really glad that I got the years that I got. I really think that I kind of fell into the sweet spot of sports journalism. You know, what the guys do today, what the guys have to do today, what guys like Gordy have to do today, it's really hard. It's really, really hard. You don't have the access to the coaches and the players that we did. You don't have you have the athletes all, you know, they all are tweeting all the time, so you're never off the clock. you know, Joel Embiid could tweet something out at 11 o'clock at night, and all of a sudden you're back working again because mm-hmm. of something he said. You know, those are the kind of things that we never had to worry about. Mm-hmm. So it's challenging. It's really challenging for the guys today. And I kind of, you know, there was a real simplicity to the humble roots of which the, we were working in the 70s. And plus, you know, I kind of got on the tail end of, you know, I got to sit in the press box next to Red Smith. I got to sit next to Jimmy Cannon. You know, I got to work with Dave Anderson. Shirley Povich. I mean, those guys, you know, they were the deans. They were the deans of the press box. And I got to spend time with them and talk to them and sit around with them and listen to them tell stories about, you know, Joe Louis and Max Schmeling. I mean, that was great stuff, you know. And I was able to get in on the tail end of that era. And then, you know, all through the 70s and the 80s, when newspapers were really great and there was a lot of money and there's a lot of space in the paper and you could kind of travel anywhere you wanted to go to research a story and all those kinds of things, there was just tremendous freedom. And newspapers were thriving. And when I went to the Daily News, the daily circulation was over 300,000. Mm. And, you know, we'll never see those days again. But yeah. I'm glad that I got to experience it.
Mm-hmm. You've often mentioned over the years, Ray, your special connection to Tommy McDonald, the Eagles Hall of Fame wide receiver. I wonder if you could just share with our listeners how that developed and why you felt such a special connection to him.
Well, it was really all about Tommy. I mean, he just took me under his wing. You know, I mean, he was just my favorite player. Mm-hmm. I had seen him play at Oklahoma on the great Bud Wilkinson team that went undefeated. Mm-hmm. Tommy never lost a game in his whole college career. Very few guys could say that. Mm-hmm. And so I was just fascinated by him, this little guy on this undefeated team. And then lo and behold, the Eagles draft him in 1957. Mm-hmm. And so my family, we always used to go to, my family, my mom and dad, and my grandparents too, were such fantastic, fanatical Eagle fans mm-hmm. that for summer vacation, you know, there was no Jersey Shore for us. Summer vacation for us was we would go to Eagles training camp up in Hershey and watch the team practice. So that was it. I mean, literally every summer, every July, my dad would take his two-week vacation from the steel plant. And we would get in the car and we would drive to Hershey and check into the Coco Inn. Wow. and go over to the field and watch the team practice twice a day, morning and afternoon. And back then there was no security, there were no fences, there were no barricades, there were no, you know, there was none of that kind of stuff. I mean, nobody went to the practices. And so you could stand right outside the locker room and talk to the players. I mean, there was nobody saying step back, none of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you literally stand on the sidelines during practice and just watch practice. I mean, some people would come, families would come with a blanket and a picnic basket, mm-hmm. and they would roll out the blanket and spread out the picnic lunch and have a picnic on the sidelines while the team was practicing. Wow. I mean, that's how informal and casual it was. But what it was such an intimate setting that it allowed a kid like me to actually, you know, meet Tommy McDonald. I mean, the first day he came out of the locker room, I went over to him with my autograph book, and I handed it to him. And to sign the autograph, he said, here, do you want to carry my helmet? Mm-hmm. And he took my book and the pen and signed my autograph. And then it became a thing. I mean, every day during our stay in Hershey, I would be there waiting for him. And he'd come out and, you know, he would hand me his helmet and I would walk with him to the practice field. Mm-hmm. And we did that every summer for every summer that he was an Eagle. And he got so used to seeing me, he called me little brother. And and then, you know, later on, I become a sports writer and I get in the business and I get to interview him. I never told him, I never made the connection to him. I never said, you know, do you remember me from, I never went there because I just thought it was kind of unprofessional. Mm-hmm. But later on, you know, I knew the one thing that he wanted. And he said this a couple times when I interviewed him, you know, yeah, I really had a great career and I really loved playing. But, you know, the only disappointment is I would have loved to have gotten in the Hall of Fame. To me, that's the ultimate. Mm-hmm. I won a championship that was great, played 12 years, met some great guys. That was all great. But I always kind of hoped I'd get in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. So as a sports writer and a member of the Hall of Fame Selectors Committee, I actually found myself in a position where I could act on that. Mm-hmm. So I began mounting sort of an internal campaign to try and get him in. Because he'd been retired for 16 years and never been on the ballot, even though he had great stats. I mean, he retired with the second most touchdown catches of any receiver in NFL history. Hmm. Don Hutson of the Packers had the most, and Tommy was number two. It just amazed me and frustrated me that, you know, how could this guy not be in the Hall of Fame? Right. But every year he got passed over. So I got to start working internally, and I finally got a little bit of momentum build up. On the ballot one year, he didn't quite get in. Then got him on the ballot another time, and that year, 1998, he finally did get in. And then, as it turned out, that he asked me, lo and behold, to be his presenter in camp. Mm. So that's kind of the story. I mean, we met. I was this little 10-year-old kid with an autograph book outside the locker room door in Hershey in 1957, and then fast forward to August 1998, and there, Tommy and I are riding in an open convertible through the streets of Canton, waving to 250,000 people on our way to the Hall of Fame, and I'm going to deliver his induction speech. So it's a pretty rare story, pretty unusual, pretty powerful, mm-hmm. definitely a feel-good story. And so, you know, I decided really should do something with this because it's so, I don't know another story quite like it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote, I had never written a play before, but I said, oh, let me give this a try. And I wrote the play Tommy and Me, and we wound up having, you know, four very successful runs with it.
Mm-hmm. That's so great. That's literally a heartwarming story, Ray. I love that. It really is.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty. I mean, I look back on it and think, how did that happen? You know, right. I mean, how did all of that sort of fall together? And the best part about it was he was such a prince of a guy. I mean, he really was. I mean, it was the way he befriended me, the way he made me feel mm-hmm. important, the way he, you know, the way he listened to everything I said, the time that he spent with me when I was just this little kid. I mean, it was just extraordinary. It mm-hmm. was so, and the kindness that he showed me, and not just me, but all the kids up there. He was just a wonderful guy, and he was that way his whole life. I mean, everybody that met him during his playing career, and then later on when he was retired, I can't tell you how many people have come up to me, and they all have a Tommy McDonald story. Mm-hmm. I mean, and most of them revolve around the King of Prussia Mall. Tommy lived. Tommy and his family lived in a house. And the family still has the house, and it's literally a Savrocka punt from the King of Mushroom Mall. It's not even 5 minutes away. And so Tommy would go to the mall every day and just walk. Uh-huh. He would just walk the whole circumference of the mall. Okay. And in the summer, you know, in the winter when it was cold, he would walk in there. In the summertime when it was hot, he would walk in there in the air conditioning. And that was it. He would just go to the King of Prussia Mall every day and just walk the mall for hours. And so that's where everybody would meet him. People would say, hey, aren't you Tommy McDonald? Yeah. And then, you know, and they all said the same thing. He stopped. He took time with us. He had this thing where he would always take, he had two rings. He had his 1960 championship ring, and he had his Pro Football Hall of Fame ring. Mm-hmm. And he would always take the rings off and then hand them to whoever it was and say, here, try these on.
Oh, wow.
And so everybody, if I've heard that story once, I've heard it 1,000 times from people that, you know, they stopped them, they talked to them at the King of Prussia Mall, mm-hmm. and they say, and you're never going to believe this. And I say, yeah, you know, I mean, you wore his chain. Yeah, how did you know? he did that with everybody. But that was just him. I mean, he was the warmest, most approachable superstar you could ever imagine. And I was lucky enough to be his friend.
That's just lovely. It really is. That's just really
pretty cool.
Ray, I can't top that. And I just feel like that's where we should end. I just think that's just such a warm tale to end on. And Mike and I can't thank you enough for taking out the time and also your insights. It's really much appreciated. And we wish you all the best. And I hope our paths cross again someday soon.
I hope so too. I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will, Gordy. I'm sure we'll see each other in one press box or another. It's always a pleasure, and it was great spending time with you guys. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Ray. Thanks, take care. Chris. Be well.
All right, take care, fellas. Good night. Bye bye.
Mike, Ray is just a treasure, and I say that without reservation. Just his insights, also just how expansive he is, and how there's never been a bone in his body that has been a big time, inclined toward big timing anybody. And so I thought that was a real treat and a real blessing to have him on. The one thing that stood out to me was how he mentioned how he had analyzed Jalen Reagor's route and still remembered it from week one of this past season.
Yeah,
that is Ray in a nutshell right there.
I would have joined the Manning crowd who would have put that interception on the quarterback. Yeah,
right.
I that would never even occur to me. But I think he's right about. I think that completely turned that game around and turned that season around. And another thing I want to say before I forget it is that I also attended the Eagles training camp in Hershey with my dad. I very, very vaguely remember that. I must have been really little, but I do remember that. And then also they had a year or two at Albright College.
Wow.
I think one time I can remember at Hershey, one time I can remember at Albright. And it really was completely different. It was unbelievable how the access you could have when you think about it in the context of what the NFL is now.
Yeah,
you
know? That's very true. Here's an oddity. I actually went to Milton Hershey School. I never went to an Eagles training camp, and I'm pretty sure they trained while I was there. Trained there while I was there. So,
well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I can't.
I was there from 1968 to 1976. I think they trained there at some point in there. Maybe
yeah,
at the very
I would
beginning.
Think in the 60s. Yeah, I would think late 60s. Yeah.
So that's a little bit of an oddity. The one thing that I wanted to ask Ray, but just didn't feel like I could after his Tommy McDonald tale, which is obviously a very personal thing with him. I did want to ask him about the whole Aaron Rodgers saga, which hung over the NFL draft, and how, in my estimation, as we've established on these podcasts, I'm a big Aaron Rodgers guy, but I just feel like there's no way that he will be there in week one, which, you know, of course saddens me. But if you're drawing a line in the sand where reportedly he has said it's either him or the GM, well, the team isn't going to fire the GM just because of one player's say so, even as great a player as he is. I mean, I think he's either going to retire or he's going to be on another team in week one. I just feel that that's how this has to play out. What's your take, Mike?
Well, it was really only today that what I read about it seemed to define it as clearly as you just did.
Mm-hmm.
It's me or the GM.
Mm-hmm.
Me meaning Rodgers. It's
sure.
Rodgers or the GM.
Sure.
And it's such, you know, I'm a Rodgers fan too. I like the guy. I think he's a really smart guy. I'd like to know what he's really thinking, because this doesn't make much sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unlikely that he's going to be in a better football situation this season than he's in Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people say, well, they were their draft this year was mostly defense. They didn't address their offense. They had one of the best offensive lines in the sport last year. They had one of the best receivers in the sport. Didn't they re-up that running back?
Aaron Jones, yes. They brought him back.
I can rely on you for the names because you're a Packers guy, Gordy. I'm not so much as much of a Packers guy. But he's not going to end. And they went 13-3 and went to the conference championship game last year. There's no way he's going to be in a better football situation next year. Plus, they're supposedly running his offense or something very close to what he would want for an offense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and plus, he was really good in that offense. He threw 48 touchdown passes and 5 interceptions last year. He was the MVP of the league. I just don't. Yes. So it's just, I mean, that reporting that it centers on the fact that they drafted his successor, Jordan Love, in the 2020 draft. that's what, and they didn't tell him about it ahead of time. Well, why should they have to? I mean, why is that a big deal?
I'm so tired of hearing that kind of stuff. Yeah. Well, I felt disrespected because X. Yes. And it's so often it's because something that has to do with the draft.
Yeah.
I didn't get drafted high enough.
Yeah.
I didn't get, you know, they didn't help me enough. They didn't consult me enough.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think they consulted Brett Favre before they drafted him?
No, which is interesting that this scenario is kind of replaying itself. That Favre retired and then attempted to unretire, and they said, no, we're going with this other guy, this number 12. And so they ended up trading Favre to the Jets for a pick that turned into Clay Matthews, by the way. So that was actually a pretty good trade. And the other part of that was, if they had held on to Favre and reinstated him as the starter, they would have lost Rodgers because he was at the end of a contract. So I think they made the right move then. Now, we have no idea what Jordan Love is. He's not played it down. Whereas by the time Favre retired and unretired, Rodgers had played a little bit, and there were some hints that maybe he was going to be pretty good. So yeah. I think the situation isn't quite the same. But at the same time, I mean, normally I would side with labor over management. But in this case, if you're the Packers, you can't fire your GM just because Aaron Rodgers doesn't like him. you just can't do it.
You can't. And also, you can't just trade him because he announces that he's unhappy. I don't know.
Yeah.
One thing about this I think is really funny, and I just want to throw this in there. Ian Rappaport, who I guess works for the NFL Network.
Yes, he does.
Of course, Rodgers did a stint guest hosting on Jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
So Rappaport reports that, my sources tell me that people were really impressed with what he did on. But first of all, you're telling me Ian Rappaport has sources in the game show world? A, and B, are we seriously implying that, like, Jeopardy is a bargaining chip here?
Yeah.
Come on. I just thought that was funny.
Yes. Speaking as a Packers fan, I mean, I do think that the moves that they made, they drafted Eric Stokes, the Georgia cornerback, which I think makes a lot of sense. And they also drafted Amari Rodgers, a Clemson receiver who would appear to fill a real need for a slot guy. I mean, to me, I thought they had a pretty, I mean, not a great draft, but a good draft where they addressed what they need. And I think their team is maybe a little bit better, but if they don't have Rodgers, they're a 500 team, clearly.
Yeah. There's no question. He is a great, great player. And he was the MVP of the league last year.
And, you know, from a personal standpoint, I'll miss him because I loved watching him play. There are two things from a sports watching perspective that I enjoy above all else. One is watching him play. The other one is watching Steph Curry when he's got it going.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
When you went that way, I knew what you were going to say. And they are, it is comparable.
Yeah.
It is comparable. It's almost like they've kind of there's a little aspects. There's aspects of it that they've kind of reinvented almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So we move on from there, and it is interesting to me. LeBron James this week came out and said that whoever invented the NBA play-in tournament should be fired. Now, he says this, ironically enough, when the Lakers are in a bit of a skid, and he has missed a bunch of time this year because of injury, and might actually wind up in the play-in tournament. I mean, I kind of like it. I think it's kind of an interesting little wrinkle, but what is your take on it, Mike?
Well, I have a couple of things. Number one, LeBron has been back for, I think, two games.
Right.
He has not played that great in either of them. And last night he left the game early with ankle soreness.
Mm-hmm.
So he has been such a superhuman athlete.
Yes, he has.
In terms of injury and recovery and workload and all of that. And I wonder if we aren't finally getting to the point where he's going to start to wear down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you expect him. It's a tribute to him, but you expect him to come back and have a 28-point triple double. You know, because he's LeBron James, and that has not happened.
Yeah.
And the Lakers are, incredibly enough, the Lakers are in a position where they might be involved in this play-in tournament. And think about who else might be involved in this play-in tournament. Steph Curry.
There you go.
Zion Williamson.
Yeah, not any bad. Damian Lillard.
Westbrook. Luka Doncic. I mean, all of the Trailblazers with Lillard.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me that in this year, where it seems more wide open than the NBA ever seems, it's not automatic who's going to win the championship or who the favorites are. I think there are 6-7 teams that can win it. That in this particular year, mm-hmm. when this play-in tournament might actually mean something,
mm-hmm.
you know, that and could be pretty entertaining, that this is the year that it happens. I just think it's sort of amazing.
Yeah. So the 6 or 7 teams, I think we can go through it. Phoenix, Philly,
yep.
Utah, Brooklyn, maybe the Clippers, Denver, the Lakers. That's probably the list, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, how about the Milwaukee Bucks?
Oh, yeah. Again, as we've discussed.
Which is another thing that, I mean, they've kind of quietly gone along.
Yeah.
And everybody sort of wrote them off because of what happened the last couple of years. But if you look at them, particularly in the context of, like, point differential,
yeah.
I mean, some of the stats that they have, they really are being slept on. And they won. They beat Brooklyn last night. And our old buddy Drew Holiday
mm-hmm.
really put the clamps on Kyrie Irving, which nobody can do.
No, I've said this before on this podcast. I don't know how anybody stays in front of that guy.
Yeah, but Drew Holiday did a pretty good job of it last night, and is a very good defender of other guards.
Yeah,
he can defend the one and the two really well. Which I think makes them intriguing. You know, I think maybe people are sleeping on Milwaukee, including me. You know, we're sleeping on Milwaukee.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously the Nets have the best big three out there with Durant, Harden, and Kyrie. And Milwaukee has an intriguing kind of, maybe not big three, but good size three with Giannis and also Drew and Chris Middleton. And then they have some really intriguing role players like the Pat Connaughtons and the Dante DiVincenzos. And I read this stat today and I thought it was a misprint. Tony Snell is shooting 57% from three. Tony Snell.
I think that was a misprint.
So yeah, but I did want to mention Drew, and he was the 17th overall pick in the 2009 NBA draft by your Sixers. And that was the Blake Griffin, James Harden, Steph Curry draft. But listen to this. After Toronto took DeMar DeRozan at number 9, the picks between DeMar DeRozan and Drew, they would be Brandon Jennings, Terrence Williams, Gerald Henderson, Tyler Hansbrough, Earl Clark, Austin Day, and James Johnson. You think maybe some teams would have wanted to redo those?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's have a do-over. Let's deal the cards again. Well, the thing with Drew Holiday was that he, if I remember this correctly, he left college after just 1 year.
I believe you're correct, yes.
He was a one-and-done guy, and he was, you know, he didn't have huge numbers, but he was on the same college team. I think I have this right, because I saw them play in Philly. On the same college team with Russell Westbrook.
Yes, you are correct.
And Collison.
Yeah, yeah.
The Collison who had a long career in the NBA. So maybe it would be hard to stand out in that crowd.
Yeah.
But I saw that team play in the NCAAs against Villanova in Philly.
And Nova won, correct?
Villanova smacked them around pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And Drew Holiday was the only one of those three. Or was it a Collison? Was it only one of those guys looked like they were interested? It looked like that team, that was near the end of Ben Howland.
Yes.
Coach at UCLA, and it looked like they had kind of crapped out on him. Mm. So none of those guys would have thought, wow, they're gonna have impact in the NBA next year, especially next year, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But Drew Holiday has turned out to be a very good player, and obviously Westbrook is I mean, all three of them had NBA careers.
Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure if Kevin Love was there then. I think he might have been just after them. I think that was.
Yeah, I think he was. I think he was close, but I think he was after them.
Yeah. So yeah, that is it's really interesting. And Jrue Holiday, he had a nice run in Philly, and then he went to New Orleans, and now he's in Milwaukee. I think that's a really good fit there, I think, for them. I think they are an interesting team. They're 40 and
Well,
20.
he's the thing that's different from last year.
Yeah,
You
right.
almost have to have a major thing different. We just can't do this same thing over again. He's the thing that's different. And of course they miss Brogdon,
Yeah.
But yeah, he I think we were all sleeping on Milwaukee a little bit.
Yeah, so I'll be interested to see. Right now, they're the third seed in the East behind your Sixers
Brooklyn and the Sixers,
and yeah, those are that's the 1-2-3. So I think that'll be interesting. I think probably getting the number one seed is probably a really good idea because you probably want to avoid Milwaukee in the second
Yeah,
round.
I agree. That makes it even more so. We were talking about that the other week,
Yeah.
and I agree with that. I think it's important that they get the number one seed. And I saw a piece from Keith Pompey today, who we've had on the show,
Yes.
who it was Doc Rivers talking, and he did not seem to prioritize getting the number one seed. It was
Well,
much more like we got to make sure everybody's rested, and we got to make sure everybody's healthy,
yeah.
and we're not going to make decisions based on the standings.
Well, I think maybe if you shot him full of sodium pentothal, he might say something else. But
That guy with true serum.
it's well intentioned on Doc's part, but I think at the same time, I think you want to be one if you can possibly pull that off.
Yeah, I do, and you made the most obvious tangible reason why is to not have to beat both Milwaukee and Brooklyn to get to the
Yeah,
finals.
I think that's a tall order. That's a really
Yeah.
tall order.
Yeah.
So, but I think we'll end on that note. And as always, I'm Gordy Jones, and that will be Mike Gross, and we'll talk to you soon.
You later.